Podcasts of Homegrown are made possible thanks to support from listeners like you. Consider becoming a member of WFPL by calling 502-814-6565 or at the website wfpl.org. Thanks. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I'm Bob Hill.
And today on the show, we've got two fabulous flowers to discuss, Bob.
We do, and one of them smells good, too.
Both of them smell good. Both of them can and do smell good.
Okay.
And, you know, they're beautiful.
They are. Roses and camellias.
It's
the higher end of gardening.
That's right. David J.C. Austin is going to join us. The David Austin name probably rings a bell. David Austin roses have been around since, I think, the first one was introduced maybe in the 60s, Bob. And the David Austin that we're interviewing today, that's his father who did all that work back then out of England. And they took the old-fashioned English roses, shrub roses, and crossed them with floribundas so that they would repeat bloom. And that's sort of been, you know, the hallmark of David Austin roses. But we're going to get more to the story of the David Austin roses today on the show. And, you know, one of the things that prompted us to do this was the fact that every couple of years, this World Rose Association, society, organization, from all the organizations from across the world, they vote on the world's favorite rose. And this year they voted the Graham Thomas rose, the world's favorite rose, and that is a David Austin rose. It's a beautiful yellow double rose. So, you know, we wanted to find out what the real history to this rose name really was. So,
plus David has a great accent.
Of course, they are indeed from England.
Being a Brit, yeah.
Working with the good old English roses. And then Cindy Watson from North Carolina.
Yeah, we had a questioner asked us a week or two ago if you can grow camellias in Louisville. The answer we said resoundingly was yes. We went right to the source. It's Cam 2 Nursery in North Carolina. And Cindy's been there for 10 years, her husband for 30 years, and they grow hundreds of thousands of camellias, of which at least 40 are hardy in the Louisville area. We're going to speak with her and get some names and numbers on how you two can grow camellias in Kentuckiana.
Absolutely. I think by show's end, we're all going to be clamoring to grow more David Austin roses and more hardy camellias. So what's going on in your garden, Bob?
Two plants I look forward to every fall. One of them is Euscapus japonicus, or the sweetheart tree. It's got a red flower on, red seed, almost like a euonymus, but it's nowhere near as invasive. Has this real, it explodes, and here's this beautiful red little flower. I love this thing, a nice bark. And then the toad lilies kick in this time of year. And I kissed one and a prince showed up.
Oh, yeah.
I did.
Oh, that's nice.
Nice prince, yeah.
And,
so,
and did you employ the prince to, work in your garden?
He weeds.
Okay, good.
But the Tricertus, the toad lily, is a nice fall plant. And I'm looking, you know, I just enjoy those two plants. It kind of talks fall to me in other ways besides the normal places. How about the Wish Estate?
Well, I'm harvesting, thanks to a listener of Homegrown. I had talked about my failure with my tomatilla plants, remember? And somebody, it looked like a cutworm just, you know, bit off the base of the tomatillos. So I was without any tomatillos earlier this spring. I come to work one day. Yeah, that's hard to say. I come to work one day and there is a Starbucks coffee cup with water in it full of tomatilla seedlings that somebody had dropped off. So whoever you are, I hope that you're listening and thank you so much for doing that. Because of you, I have a fabulous tomatillo harvest. They're in a basket on the kitchen table right now, waiting to be roasted and turned into salsa or some other things. And tomatillos have these, it almost tastes like a tangy tomato, if that makes sense.
I know you brought some in for us.
I haven't today, actually, because they literally are still on the kitchen table waiting to be roasted. But I will. I'll make some salsa, some roasted tomatillo salsa, and I'll bring it in. I usually put oranges in with it because that kind of balances the tangy and some other things. So I'll make some of that and bring it in next week. How about that?
And can you save the seeds and grow your own tomatillo?
Probably, yeah. I think he's not quite sure how to say it, but yeah.
I know he's not
Yeah, you could, absolutely. Maybe that's what I should do since I need to have lots of little seedlings to increase my chances of success.
I need you to bring some in.
All right. So. Okay, I will. I will get on that, Bob, and I'll make you all some salsa, and then you can taste how cool tomatillos are.
Basketball, salsa, chips, football, I guess.
There we go. Yeah. All right, so that's that. On to David Austin roses. Did you ever grow David Austin roses in your garden?
I've tried fitfully, and I've got to get back to it because, and we'll discuss this later probably. I've done the knockout rose thing, and I want to get beyond that. I want to have something
else.
It's
time to move beyond.
Yeah, because they're just like almost like Bradford pears anymore. Uh-huh. They're just everywhere, and some are better than others. And
I need to definitely add to the collection, so I'm interested in this. Yeah. We grew up with Abraham Darby and Graham Thomas, and I think it's time that I take more David Austin roses seriously.
Fred and Abraham.
All the names are kind of funny. I'm not quite sure who everybody is, but they're good roses. All right, David J.C. Austin is joining us now. He's the managing director of David Austin Roses in Wolverhampton, England. That was started by his father, David C.H. Austin. The David Austin Rose tradition began over 50 years ago when David C.H. Austin sought to breed a rose with the robust bloom and fragrance of the old English roses, Bob, and then the repeat bloom of the new types of roses. He succeeded and went on to breed hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of roses since. This year, in fact, Graham Thomas was named the world's favorite rose by the Distinguished World Federation of Rose Societies. David, welcome to Homegrown. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Certainly. Listen, how did it all begin? David Austin Roses, the original David Austin, if I may add, is your father.
Yeah, my father, yeah. He, as a young man, he became interested in gardening in general quite early on, which is quite unusual because most young boys don't really get into that, although I similarly was quite interested, but probably influenced by him. And he got into the idea of plant breeding at an early age because there was a local nursery that introduced a new range of lupins known as Russell lupins, which were quite a sensation in the area and, in fact, probably worldwide at the time. So the idea that you could do something exciting with plants was something that had occurred to him, and he was influenced by it at an early age, and he started to breed plants at a very young age.
And, is this like in the 1950s or so? 1940s, 1950s?
Well, he was born in 1926.
Okay.
So we're talking about the late 30s.
Okay. So he's gets interested in an early age in plant breeding.
Yeah.
And it evolves into
He goes for roses as something that he was disappointed by. He liked the old-fashioned roses, which are typically those with lots of petals that tend to open to really nice shapes and are wonderfully fragrant. He was really attracted to that style of rose, but they'd gone out of fashion. The popular rose then, as it is really even now, is the hybrid tea, which is distinct for its obviously its pointed bud, really. Mm-hmm. He didn't like the hybrid tea, but the great thing about hybrid tea was it did repeat flower, whereas most of the old roses only flowered once. So he had the very simple idea of trying to cross the two together so that you get the beauty and the fragrance from the old-fashioned rose and the repeat flowering and the improved disease resistance that's come with more breeding from the modern rose. So he started with that concept before he was 20 years old.
Hmm. So it's different from all the others, and thus the David Austin Rose tradition begins. What was the breeding process like back then compared to what you guys are doing now?
Yeah, well, I can remember as a young boy. See, my father's profession, up until the age of around about 30, was a farmer, and I can see this greenhouse on the farm broken down, not particularly good condition, with these seedlings in. Uh-huh. That was his a passion and a hobby, but at the time it was questionable whether he should, because he had a young family and had his farm to run, whether he actually should be spending a great deal of time on this. Right. It was very small scale, did it all himself. Mm-hmm. Today, you contrast that with today's breeding, has a team of, I think, 25 people with about 2 acres of glass, and we have something in the order of 100 or 150,000 plants growing outside on trial. So we've gone from the smallest scale you can imagine to one of the biggest breeding programs in the world.
What was the process like in particular? How did your dad make that first? Was it Constant Spry was the first one?
That's right. His first commercial rose was Constant Spray. I think it was launched along with Chianti in 1960. And that was as a direct result of a meeting with Graham Thomas, who is within the rose world is a very famous old rose specialist, was a very famous old rose specialist. Mm-hmm. And my father took these two roses to see Graham to ask his opinion, to see whether he thought he was going in the right direction. And more than say he was going in the right direction, he said, I'll introduce those roses for you. So that was a really important moment in his career, mm-hmm. that this top man said that what he was doing was a great idea and he was going in the right direction. The problem with Constant Spray just flowers once in the summer. So it was just his early work in terms of getting to where he wanted to be, and it wasn't until about 1970 that he'd actually got the first varieties
that repeat.
Did what he wanted them to do, repeat flowering.
Mm-hmm. How long did the first one take, the Constant Spray?
Well, the breeding process today is approximately 10 years. Mm-hmm. I would say in those days, he probably got, that rose may have been just 5 or 6 years before, because if you've only got a handful of seedlings, you can soon pick the best. And in those days, in terms of being concerned of disease resistant, repeat flowering, that was a minor consideration. It was just a beautiful rose. Mm-hmm. And what was great, a fantastic climbing rose as well. So it was a much shorter process in those days. It's much more difficult now because we have to obviously compare them against the existing varieties and make sure they're really different, and also really rigorously test them to make sure they not only meet our European conditions, but also all the different conditions all over the world.
Mm-hmm. So, David, what are the crosses between that are typically used? Is it the same old rose with, you know, something that's going to give it that repeat bloom vigor? Or is there experimentation between different species?
Yeah, there are an enormous amount of roses used in the breeding program. Mm-hmm. Now, I would guess in the order of 200 different varieties. Okay. But many of those will be seedlings of our own, mm-hmm. which have shown promise in a certain direction, maybe disease resistance, but really are not beautiful enough to put on the market.
So is there like back crossbreeding as well?
Absolutely, okay. Yeah, a little bit. Okay. But we rarely go back to a hybrid tea. Mm-hmm. We will bring in new varieties as they come through that we think are adding something to the rose world. Mm-hmm. And we will intercross between our own varieties, and we will go to seedlings that haven't quite made it but have a certain characteristic that we're looking for.
So you've got to have an amazing eye for detail when it comes to this, don't you? To find, to be able to see those special qualities in a field of seedlings. Are you doing any of that work, or does your dad still do that, or do you have just a whole host of people?
He works closely with a gentleman called Carl, who's worked for him for about 20 years nearly now. They do all the selection of the crosses, and they do the early stage selection. I'm in the fortunate position that I don't have to worry about the early stage. They eliminate all the ones that are not good. And I get to see the best 200 out of what could have been 8,000 original seedlings. Uh-huh. In any one year, I get to see the 200 that have gone through the process maybe 4 or 5 years into the breeding program. What's interesting is that the first flowering, you could say that if any consumer would pick 90% of the roses.
Right.
Because they're all, on the first flowering, they're all fantastic.
So you got to do the
second flowering. In Europe, we only tend to get two really good flowerings. In parts of the United States, you'll get three and sometimes even four flowerings. But for us, we get two really good flowerings. And it's really that second flowering, which is just actually coming to its end now. So that, in fact, there's masses of roses at the nursery at the moment. Mm-hmm. And you really get to see those that can really withstand the disease pressure that's around. And you can imagine at our nursery with thousands and thousands of roses, disease is everywhere. We also have a very humid climate, so things like black spot spread very easily. So these roses really have to struggle to show their quality. And in fact, you know, in terms, as I say, in terms of beauty, they're all beautiful. But when it comes down to that final period, it's amazing how few really are good enough.
The research now being done, is some in Tyler, Texas also, or is it all done in England, or where is it being done?
Well, all the breeding takes place here in England, but we've got some extensive trials in the United States now, and I think we like to think we're getting more and more thorough with our evaluation of our roses, because climates vary so much. Right. There is actually a saying that you roses bred in a hotter climate will never go to a cool climate like ours, because the disease pressure is so much greater. We can bring our cooler climate roses into the warmer climates in the United States, but we still, our biggest problem, sometimes they might grow a little bit too big, which is manageable but more difficult for the gardener. So we have 12 sites around the United States where we have extensive collections of our roses that we visit and we have reports on. So we're getting much more detailed information on which varieties do best in all the different mm-hmm. types of climates.
Are those U.S. grown ones the ones that are in fact sold in the U.S.?
Absolutely. Yeah. Unfortunately, there is a quarantine law that prevents us from shipping from the U.K. into mm-hmm. America. Mm-hmm. But the roses are grown in America. They're all at U.S. grown, and they're fantastic, obviously fantastic. Well, you've got great growing conditions there in the mm-hmm. commercial fields, which is great news.
I have one other odd question for you. What's your opinion of something like the knockout rose, which I think is introduced to a lot of gardens? People wouldn't grow roses previously. Do you find they begin with that and grow on to other things?
Exactly. I saw that rose near Philadelphia about 3 or 4 years ago, and it did look really good. Mm-hmm. It's a very, in the right conditions. Again, very few roses will grow brilliantly in every condition, but that is a very good rose. And as you say, it gets people into roses. And it's interesting that often people look at a single rose, which obviously has, when we say a single rose, we mean a small, usually about 5 petals. People are often drawn to those, but they go from those single roses, they get into the more full-flowered roses, the mm-hmm. double rose, and our style of rose, and their knowledge of roses increases. They gravitate towards our style of rose, it seems. But they're, you know, a single rose can be beautiful, but it is obviously limited by its simplicity. Mm-hmm. Right. Our flowers, when you actually study them, and if you see some of the on the website, you see some of the fantastic photography. They're photogenic because they're beautiful, because they're complex. You've got so many petals, and the way the light falls on them, the way they open gradually opened as they mature, that obviously more complex and more beautiful, I think.
You know, David, they really are. If you peer into one of the David Austin roses and that full flower that you're talking about, if people are not familiar with it, it literally is like a teacup full of flower petals.
Absolutely.
You know?
I mean, there are literally hundreds mm-hmm. of petals. It's incredible, you know. And when you see sometimes the buzz that the flower starts from, it's incredible to think how they then form into these huge, huge blooms and mm-hmm. with all this fragrance, isn't it? Yeah. It's truly amazing.
Well, and that's another thing we haven't touched on, and let's kind of talk about the tradition. I grew up in my family garden with Abraham Darby, which is a David Austin rose, mm-hmm. And kind of grew up knowing that these particular, you know, Bob had mentioned the knockout rose, that's mm-hmm. the rose that everybody thinks is so vigorous and so easy to grow, but I grew up with the tradition of recognizing that the David Austin roses were equally easy to grow, quite vigorous. They had all these other qualities about them, like fragrance, and they could fit in different areas of the garden. So let's talk about the versatility of this particular rose compared to, you know, the hybrid tea and that sort of thing you know, a little more leggy and not as luscious all season round.
I visited the Tyler Rose Garden recently, mm-hmm. Where we've got quite a good display of our roses, and the difference between the hybrid tea and our roses is just immense. I mean, the hybrid teas in Tyler were growing well. You know, they're good. They're a good garden, but they are so sparse, you know, by comparison. I mean, they are really a different plant. You can't really compare them. And they kind of really just do one thing. Our roses are so much more full in their shrubby nature. They are like we call them shrub roses for that very reason. And as you say, the versatility of them, and in terms of their form, some great climbers. Some of the varieties we have are fabulous climbers, but you can actually take the same rose and actually prune it and keep it as a shrub, which confuses the gardener a little bit. How can a rose be a shrub and a climber? Well, it's just a matter of the way you control the growth and where you plant it. Mm-hmm. If you put a Graham Thomas against a wall, it will climb, you know, it will spread, and you'll get a fantastic climber. If you put it in a more open position as a shrub and just make sure you prune it, you'll get a beautiful shrub. So they are incredibly versatile and great for things like hedging plants. You know, I think we could do much more as gardeners with roses in general, particularly our roses, to form hedges. I've got some great hedges in my own garden here in England. There's so many things you can do with a rose that people, you know, don't really kind of think about. They're brilliant in containers. You know,
so
what could be better?
Are they more or less thornier or not so thorny? I kind of recall pretty thorny.
On the whole, they're not too thorny. There are one or two exceptions, and there are one or two that are really almost thornless. James Galway is virtually thornless, and that's a great one for as a climber. And a variety that is not so well known, perhaps generally, and deserves to be better known, is one called Mortimer Sackler. That's virtually thornless, but it is an issue for people. And a rose is not a rose unless it has thorns.
Indeed. Hear, hear.
David, you just mentioned recently the Graham Thomas, which was modestly voted the world's favorite rose. Give us a story on that.
Oh, that's tremendous. That's tremendous. I mean, it was for us. I mean, my father was honoured by the Queen with an OBE, Order of the British Empire.
Wow.
Fantastic honour for his work and service to horticulture. But without question, the award, to get the award for the best rose in the world, was a great honour to him than that.
Absolutely.
It was voted for by over 40 rose societies all around the world. And it is a truly great rose. Its unique character really was the fact in old-fashioned roses you don't get a full yellow rose. So when it came out in the early 80s, I think it was 82 or 83, it was an absolute sensation because it was truly so different and the colour was totally unique. It's a fabulous rose. Obviously, I go back to the story of Graham Thomas, who gave him the inspiration. So the fact that he was a big man in roses in general, and he encouraged my father, then he named a rose after him, and then it becomes 25 years later.
Oh.
It's just, it kind of all fits
it's
together. You couldn't have planned it. You know,
it's
fantastic. A great, truly great honor for a great rose.
It's great. David, thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
And for all the work that you guys do over there to bring us beautiful roses.
Thank you very much. We're still working at it.
All right. Thank you. David J.C. Austin is the managing director of David Austin Roses, based in Wolverhampton, England. For 50 years, the breeding program there has produced and released thousands of varieties of roses worthy of the name. This year, their Graham Thomas shrub rose was named the world's favorite rose. Of course, for more information about David Austin Roses, please see our website at wfpl.org.
Coming up next, hardy camellias for the fall and winter garden. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL.
Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
Sweet smelling Bob Hill here.
Sweet smelling. Let's keep it going, man. There's more sweet smelling stuff to talk about. More beautiful blooms, sweet smelling blooms from time to time.
In a word, camellias.
Camellia comes to mind, indeed.
Which you grow, right?
Actually, I don't have any camellias. No.
And I've tried them fitfully over the years, but I think I may do it again. We've got a woman that can really get me fired up on the subject. It's Cindy Watson. She and her husband, Ray, have owned Cam 2 Camellia Nursery in Greensboro, North Carolina, for almost 30 years. It's the biggest wholesale seller of camellias in the country. And they have 40 hybrids that are hardy in our zone, Zone 6 Louisville. So she's with us today to talk about those hardy camellias, along with many other things. So, Cindy, welcome to Homegrown.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, I enjoyed the name of your nursery, Cam 2, C-A-M-T-O-O. Kind of fill us in first on what that was all about.
Well, my husband had 4 car parts stores in Greensboro many years ago.
Oh, camshafts.
And so it was camshafts and things to do with that. And he went to camellia shows. He was growing some rhododendron and azaleas in his backyard. He went to some camellia shows where they just had the little cups of water with the flowers in them for judging purposes, and thought he'd grow some camellias because he couldn't find any local that would live. And then he thought he'd grow some for Guilford County. And then he says it's a hobby that got out of hand.
Right.
Sold the car parts stores and started growing the camellias full time.
And that's Cam, too.
Yeah.
What a great name.
That's fabulous.
And that was back in 82.
Yes, he started with just a couple houses, and he went to some conventions, some trade show conventions, and thought about 150 plants was a lot and found out it wasn't. And so now we have 200 greenhouses and 60 acres of camellias.
Oh, my gosh.
So camellias are a plant that you all see in the Carolinas a little bit more frequently than we would see here in Kentuckiana. Give us a little bit of the background in terms of what their native scope is, what the typical habitat is for the camellias.
Camellias are originally from China. They were on the sides of mountains, and they emigrated a little bit to Japan. So they do like a little bit of water, but they like it to wash away down the side of the mountain. So they like to be very well drained, just like mountain laurel or rhododendrons on the side of a hill or a mountain. That's the same culture. They don't like to be in a windy area. Probably the drainage and the wind protection is the most important.
Are there any native species of camellias here in North America, or are they all Asian?
Not of what you're thinking of as a camellia. A tree called Stewardia that blooms in the middle of the summer is in the camellia family, and also Franklinia, which was native to Georgia and is now extinct, is in the camellia family, and the camellia family is called Theaceae, T-H-E-A, and much longer, and that's where the word tea comes from.
Because
the Chinese,
tea leaves.
There's over 100 different types of camellias, not just names, there's thousands of names, but there's over 100 different types, species, and one type is where your iced tea and your green tea come from, and that is what the colonists wanted, because the tea had come to England and they got hooked on their tea. But at the time, it was very commercially valuable, and so China instead sent us the big flowered ones, which in 1600s weren't important.
Okay. Because the flower over the foliage sort of thing, and then the ones that are more foliagey for tea probably don't have the big flowers.
Right. They have a flower that's only about the size. There's a one that's only about the size of a dime, and then the others are about the size of a quarter.
Okay.
Well, Boston Tea Party to follow.
That's right.
That's right.
The Boston Tea Party
was big business.
Tea leaves, camellia leaves, excuse me.
Don't tax our tea.
Don't tax our camellias.
Yeah.
Well, for the unlucky.
They had the flowers and the tea went to Europe and Italy. You'll see a lot of the flower gardens through Italy. They weren't so much interested in the tea, but the tea and the flowers work their way to England, and they also work their way to California, coming directly from the Asian side. But from Europe and England, they started to be imported into Philadelphia and into South Carolina. Magnolia Plantation in Charleston is one of the first places to start planting them outside and for someone to start hybridizing.
For the unlucky listeners who haven't seen camellias or don't know much about them, can you kind of describe what makes a camellia a camellia?
Well, if you can think of the leaves of a rhododendron, a big, glossy, evergreen leaves, and then the flowers can look anywhere as a single rose to a double rose, very showy, although there are some that are very small, just an inch or two across, just a little bowl or cup-shaped flower. You can have a very wide variance of 1 inch to 10 inches across, depending on what type will live in your area. So usually people refer to them as winter roses because they bloom anywhere between September, with different types blooming all the way through April.
Mm-hmm. How about fragrance?
There are some fragrant ones. Usually the flowers are single or semi-double that you see the yellow stains in the center. It's the pollen that's really the fragrant part. The ones that are the perfect formal double, as if it's so many petals just layered upon each other, those are not fragrant.
Okay.
And so even the ones that are slightly fragrant, it's not similar to a rose. It's just a scent. Mm-hmm. That's what they call a fragrant camellia.
So, Cindy, in the last, I want to say 10, 15 years, for people like us in, you know, a zone 6, we've had opportunities where we can get our hands on fabulous, what we consider hardy camellias for our area. Is there a backstory to that whole thing in terms of breeding a camellia that, you know, could be a little bit more versatile across the country?
Yes. It started in the 70s and 80s. The National Arboretum in Washington, D.C. Has a large Asian collection of plants, camellias, azaleas, rhododendron, and many other plants, and mm-hmm. they had a very bad freeze. And they had over 900 different camellias in there, and they all died except for two.
Oh, and that's one way to weed out the winners, huh?
One of the men that worked there, Dr. Ackerman, mm-hmm. took it upon himself to make it a project that he took the one that lived, which was a species. It just had a single little white flower that didn't make big, colorful flowers. It just mm-hmm. had a single white flower. It did have a lot of seed pods. And that's where you get tea oil from.
Ah.
Camellia oleifera.
Right.
Gets many, many seed pods, and the Chinese press those, and you get cooking oil, cosmetics, and medicines.
Uh-huh.
But he started hybridizing that one with some of the colored varieties and the bigger flowers to impart some hardiness into them. And most of his are fall bloomers, because that's when the oleifera blooms, but a few of his are spring bloomers. And then Dr. Parks in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, has gone to China several times and brought back different types and species and has bred and interbred mostly japonicas to japonicas. He has more of spring bloomers, although he has bred fall bloomers that are cold hardy.
So is the Chapel Hill program a little younger than the Dr. Ackerman breeding program?
Probably not.
Okay, so they've been around equal. Okay.
They're probably about even. It's just they went about it in different ways.
Okay.
And what they were breeding for was the cold hardiness of the flower buds, mm-hmm. because the plants always usually lived, even the ones in Asian Valley, if they were killed to the ground, it's like a crepe myrtle, they would come back
from the roots.
But there have been camellias on Long Island and New York for 100 years, and some of them would bloom because they were in a protected area mm-hmm. and out of the wind. And so what these men were really breeding for was that the buds would be cold hardy to minus 15 because the plants were living anyhow. But without the flowers, you might as well have a euonymus.
Right.
And
they're
trying to get the flowers, especially the spring flowers, to come through the freezes. The fall flowers usually miss any freezes because it doesn't get that bad by the time they're done.
Uh-huh. So how do they tolerate kind of the other extreme, heat and humidity?
It doesn't seem to bother them as long as there's good air circulation.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't have good air circulation for any plant, you can get a fungus.
Mm-hmm.
And so you just need to plant any type of plant that you ever do. Just make sure it's not too close with others, and you just have good air circulation go all the way around. And
And then that good drainage that you were talking about because of being native to the sides of mountains and such.
Yes, because we have red clay here, and they do fine. It's just, you know, you just don't plant them in a low area. If you see it rain and a half hour later there's still a puddle of water there, don't plant a camellia or any broadleaf evergreen, a holly, an azalea, rhododendron. It's just not going to like it. It's a sink, and it will drown.
Now, your website mentions you have 40 hybrids at least that are hardy in Zone 6. Can you mention a couple of those that are in? You're a wholesale nursery, I should stress that, so people cannot order from you, but they can ask their nurserymen to order from you. So give us some best ones, maybe for the Louisville area to get started with.
Well, the fall bloomers, which will bloom any time, we call fall anywhere between September and Christmas. Any of the ones that start with the word winter, that was Dr. Ackerman's series.
Right.
We have more than 40 varieties. That website needs to be updated. But Northern Exposure, Snow Flurry, Survivor, Mason Farm, Twilight Glow.
So many of the names say it for you, don't they?
Oh, yeah. They say it for you, and they are very well specified. All you have to do is ask your local garden center or landscaper for a Zone 6 camellia, and they will know what you're talking about. And then the ones for spring, Dr. Park's series starts with the word April. Anything word April is blooming in anywhere between January, March, April. There's Pink Icicle, Jerry Hill, a man's named Jerry Hill.
All right.
And well, finally, he's a familiar hybridizer up in Washington, D.C.
Okay, Uncle Jerry, yeah.
Ron still has a garden center there. Now, Udell Gardens in Crestwood has been ordering a small amount for the last couple years, so they would be a start for people trying to find some.
Okay. And probably amassing a good collection there so that we can all go visit and see how they perform
them
there.
She is planting them outside so you can see getting to be mature heights, because that is another thing, that if people visit Myrtle Beach or Charleston area, they see huge monster camellias that can take up the side of a building. Well, there are many different habits, and there are ones that can be foundation plants that will not get above your window, and you don't have to prune them. And there are ones that can take full sun, even though they all would prefer afternoon shade. It's usually the fall bloomers, at least it's the ones with the smaller leaves, can take sun. So you look at your spot and choose the correct plant for that spot.
So there's variation.
Now, would they be best sited here, like against an east or south facing wall, maybe in zone 6A, 6B, you think?
Everybody has a different opinion about that, and it's also based on what you have near the wall. We have some completely surrounding our house. We have some on the west side of the house, but there are trees 20 feet away. By saying west side, they're not really in direct sun.
Right.
On the north side of the house, of any building, they're being kept cold longer, which is the considered opinion of many people is better for the spring bloomers, because that way they're not warmed up during the day, and they get a cold blast at night, and maybe the buds start to open and then are frozen. So by staying really cold until it starts to warm up on a regular basis on the north side, that might be best. But you can get away with them anywhere, given that it's the correct plant. The smaller leaves, the zone hardiness, it's just a little bit of trial and error sometimes.
Sure. So soil pH, a little on the acid side, a little low pH.
Not
like
that much.
Other broadleaf evergreens?
6.5.
Oh, okay. So not
really. You do not have to go far acid.
Okay. Great.
It's very an easy plant to take care of. Once it's established, it does not, after 1 year, it does not want to be watered. Extremely drought tolerant, drought loving. They do not have a lot of roots like an azalea, and so most people do kill them by overwatering, thinking that they're, oh, there's something special I have to take care of.
How big will I get? How tall?
Well, it depends on the variety. We have ones that don't get above 2 foot, and they're 8 foot wide, and we have ones that get to 14, 16 foot within a few years. So again, if you know the place you're going to put it, and you know whether you like to prune or not, you choose your special one.
You know, on an average cool fall, How long are the blooms going to last, Cindy, you know, once they open? A couple of days? Can they last longer if the temperature's, you know, right?
They last a few days, probably maybe even almost 2 weeks if you don't get a heavy rain or a blast of cold air. Mm-hmm. And what is good about them is they usually do not open all at once. So even if you do get a slight frost, there are buds left open again.
So it's a good long display.
The longest one to bloom 4 months once it's established is Snow Flurry. It is a meteor of flowers. Mm-hmm. It's just amazing, the flowers on that plant. But they usually are not like a rose that they open all at once. They're more sporadic.
Mm-hmm. Well, Cindy, you know your camellias, and you've got me fired up to try some now again. I've done it fitfully over the years, but now I'm going to dedicate my rest of my life
to growing
camellias.
We're both going to have
amazing.
More camellias.
They can pretty much replace any plant
in more David Austin
the area because they have flowers. They can pretty much replace any plant in the garden with their different habits. Some are arching like a fountain. Some are very tight as a little meatball. Some are tall and narrow as a Leland cypress.
Wow.
So you really have many choices. It's not just the big type that, I can't even think of a word for it, that just those big blown up ones that you see in Charleston and that are
just
gorgeous.
Just a big old shrub.
But there's so many townhouses now or smaller yards. There's many more ways of using them. And some of them lend themselves very well to trellising or espalier on the side of a wall if you don't have room. Instead of a climbing rose or a pyracantha, these don't have thorns. They keep their leaves, and they can be blooming at Christmas and Thanksgiving when your guests come.
All right. Good sale.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Cindy. We appreciate your time.
Okay.
Cindy and Ray Watson have owned CAM2 Camellia Nursery in Greensboro, North Carolina for almost 30 years. For more information on their nursery or camellias you can grow in the Louisville area, visit the homegrown page at WFPL.org.
Coming up next, we've got listeners' questions and another chapter in Bob's Plant Stories. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I remain Bob Hill.
And Bob, we've got a couple of questions to address.
Yeah, one of them is rootless radishes.
Rootless.
Sounds like...
You know what? If you're a rootless radish, you are out of luck, aren't you?
It's Diana. Do you have any thoughts about why I've never been able to get vegetables such as radishes and beets to provide proper roots? I had some success with Denver half-long carrots this year, but not as usual with the radishes. I heard this indicates too much nitrogen in the soil. I do not fertilize except with compost. Thanks for any advice you can give, short of giving up and buying those veggies at a farmer's market. You can do that,
which
too.
Which, that's the good alternative, I
sure
guess,
is.
If you can't grow them yourself. Okay, so she did mention the fact, Bob, that she's heard poor root development is too much nitrogen in the soil.
Right.
And that's true. Like, you basically, root crops, like carrots and beets and radishes, they don't need a whole lot of nitrogen fertilizer because that's the foliage part.
That's the leaf.
And since she's using compost, it sounds like she's doing all the right things. Plus, that compost is going to help the soil, you know, have a better tilth, more loamy, so the roots can actually develop easily. This is my guess. All of these crops, radishes, beets, and carrots, all like seed germination soil temperatures on the cool side.
You betcha.
So Diana, if I were you next year, I want to see you plant out your radishes, your carrots, and your beets. Put out all that seed as early as you can in terms of the weather. I usually, Bob, get those seeds planted out by the end of March.
That's what I was going to guess.
Yeah. And as a consequence, usually have really good luck. So I do think it's related to soil temperature for you. Ideal seed germination is going to be around 60 to 65 degrees. Anything warmer than that, it's harder for those roots to establish.
And Diana, we're going to drive by your yard next March and peer over the fence.
And remind you that it's time to put your seeds out. Or maybe we could just talk about it on the radio, Bob. How about that?
Radishes, Homeland Security.
All right, here's an email from Tammy, Janine, and Bob. We have a Bradford pear, and the leaves are turning brown like it's fall. I have not seen any others looking this way. The tree started at the end of last season, and the leaves started turning again at the beginning of this summer. Do you know what is wrong with our tree, and if we can fix it? I've attached two pictures.
Well, it's fall.
It is fall, but she did say that it started to turn earlier in the beginning of the summer. Not but unusual.
The picture she sent indicates to me kind of normal Bradford pear color. It turns that reddish.
They look really healthy, in fact.
Yeah, they do.
Bradford pears look really healthy.
Yeah, and hers, the picture looks fine, so I just think it's normal leaf turning.
Well, and Bradford pears are variable, and because they're overplanted, people have expectations that they all need to act like the masses, right?
Right.
Like it's socialistic or something.
They're like people.
They're like, wait a minute, mine's turning, but my neighbor's isn't turning. They're variable. There's going to be different factors involved in stress or not stress. We had a lot of rain, so that can sort of expedite the whole thing. The leaves of the trees are draining that chlorophyll right now, Bob. And that draining of the chlorophyll, that green color, goes back into the tree, and all that stuff's going to be converted from sugars to starches and all that. And there'll be the reserves to get the tree through the winter, dormant period. They are finished photosynthesizing and using those leaves, you know? And, you know, by now, it's a perfectly safe and agreeable and normal time in which that to occur.
I'm with you, kid.
So, yeah, I wouldn't worry about it, particularly since the pictures she sent, her trees look really healthy.
They do.
Just senescing early is all.
Better than a lot of Bradfords, in fact.
That's right.
If you have a question for Bob or Janine, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org. Email us at homegrown@WFPL.org. Call us at 502-814-8246. Or write us a letter. We keep begging, no letters ever. 619 South 4th Street, Louisville, Kentucky, 40202.
All right, Bob, it's a plant story day. What do you have for us?
The classic autumn aster.
Ah.
I'm always surprised at what I find out when I get into these things, because aster seems pretty normal in day-to-day, but it's not. It's one of those classic fall-blooming flowers you look forward to this time of year. It's native to North and South America, Europe, Asia, and Africa. there's not much left. Our best-known ones are the New York aster, the Michaelmas, I guess it is, or Novi Belgii. So named because New York was once known as New Belgium.
Sure.
I had no idea.
The Dutch were just there recently, I heard.
Yeah. Well, they're the ones that
planting tulips and stuff.
But you don't think of Belgium. Brooklyn. Well, I guess you should.
Brooklyn, yeah.
The New England aster, the Novi Anglii, as in New England, and Alma Potski is the best one there. It's a tall rose one. I've grown that one from time to time. There's also the Italian aster, the Alpine aster, the climbing aster. It goes to 12 feet. Never heard of it. The white wood aster, which I think is cool.
Mm-hmm.
The heath aster, the Calician aster, and of course the Frickert's aster.
Of course.
Whoever Frickert was. But one of the best, our buddy Alan Bush recommends this, and I agree, is the Aster oblongifolius. Mm-hmm. Here we go with that one.
Mm-hmm.
October skies and radon's favorite. As a whole, they grow from 6 inches to 12 feet tall. They've been hybridized and bred to death, but they bloom in blue, pink, red, violet, double white, ruby, and purple. But the name derivation is something that hits you upside the head when you think about it. Aster is the Greek name for star, and the flowers are star-shaped.
Mm-hmm.
But think about this. Asteroids floating around in space.
Mm-hmm.
I never put the two together. Asterisk, like in a book.
A star.
Yeah. And if your birthday's in September, that's the month of the aster.
Huh.
All those things.
How about that?
The Greeks used the asters to drive away serpents and snakes. The Romans decorated their gods with them. The Chippewa Indians, this is in your neck of the woods, smoked it to attract game, so they may have been hallucinogenic at the time. And the Latter-day Americans used it to decorate their yards. Good fall plant.
Yeah, and then the Latter-day Americans used it to decorate their yards.
Comes with a poem. If you're trying to avoid the annual disaster, if your autumnal world you must soon master, then here is the choice to use ever after. Get out there and buy the perennial aster. Its history is fun if good use of it you makes. You can plant it, smoke it, or drive away snakes. And if there's but one plant you want to discuss, I sincerely recommend the oblongifolius. But watch out for one thing as you turn over the ground. Here is the warning I feel obligated to sound. If you don't do it right, you'll be courting disaster. Your work will be labeled as strictly half-aster.
All right. Thank you very much.
Yes, indeed.
For all you people that want to decorate your yards
with the
aster. A little more information.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks, Bob. Well, that ends another edition of Homegrown. We do indeed hope that you join us next week for another show.
Homegrown is produced by the always rosy Brad Yost in the studios of WFPL. I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishy. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.